From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Record numbers of people are voting early, and which candidates are benefiting the most? Plus, a federal jury found Senator Ted Stevens guilty on 7 corruption counts. Now he's got to face the voters on Tuesday. Will his case hurt other Republicans? Here for the latest on politics, we've got Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She's an author and nationally syndicated columnist, and Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. How you guys doing?
Great.
Good.
So we are in the home stretch. Can you believe it?
Oh, thank God.
I know. I am with you. Anyway, let's quickly talk about Ted Stevens, Alaska senator found guilty on Monday, 7 counts of corruption charges. He was accused of trying to hide more than $250,000 in gifts and services tied to a home renovation. So, Ron, he's up for re-election next week, and he says he's going to keep campaigning for his seat. John McCain and other GOP officials say step down. So should he take one for the team and step aside?
Of course he should. I mean, this is a case that baffles me. You're given the highest honor and trust and privilege to represent your constituents, be it from the state of Alaska or my beloved home state of California. If, in fact, you have been tried before a jury of your peers and a very serious case like, such as this, where there were 7 specific counts alleging misconduct, and he was found guilty in all counts that were alleged against him, for the good of the people of the state of Alaska, he needs to go. He needs to go for his state, he needs to go for his party, and he needs to go for the good of the country. I think it's a stain over him, a stain over his legacy. In fact, it's just a travesty to me that he hasn't stepped down.
Donna, do you think, first of all, just quickly, do you think there's a chance he will just get reelected based on whether or not people like him or they just feel aggravated by the case or whatever reasons they have? But secondly, could it hurt the Republican Party?
Well, on the first question, there's no doubt that when you think of the state of Alaska, 50 years old this year, Ted Stevens has been the only senator that they have known throughout their entire state history. So he is well liked by you know, individuals in that state. But I believe that the Republicans, like Democrats, are going to vote for a change, and Mayor Mark Begich of Anchorage might have an edge. You know, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has also called for Ted Stevens to resign. John McCain has called for him to resign. There are a number of vulnerable Republican lawmakers this election cycle that's also joining the chorus, including Norm Coleman of Minnesota and Gordon Smith of Oregon. And lastly, I think this is the one that really should cause some news in Alaska, is that Governor Sarah Palin has also called on Ted Stevens to resign. So this is clearly not a good moment for the Republicans. He joins a gallery of disgraced leaders, Bob Ney, Tom DeLay, Randy Duconyham. Of course, there are other lawmakers right now in hot water on both sides of the aisle. But
William
Ted
Jefferson.
Stevens should. Mr. Maloney down in Florida. So, you know, when it comes to disgracing the United States Congress, we can all go through a laundry list, but this is a very special thing. Ted Stevens is now a convicted felon, and who knows if he can even cast a vote for himself in Alaska.
All right, Ron, I want to move on to a topic on a lot of people's minds, which is early voting. CNN reports that more than 1 million ballots have already been cast in Georgia alone. The Obama campaign has encouraged voters to cast their ballots early, but we don't hear that message coming as much from the McCain campaign. Why is that?
Well, I think the McCain campaign right now is trying to devote all their tactical attention to getting out the vote, to making sure that all the precincts, all the neighborhoods, all the areas that are Republican strongholds, that they can utilize those resources and encourage their supporters to get out and vote. I would caution the listeners, however. I mean, I remember back in 2004, and we looked at the numbers in North Carolina, and we had heard that there were 50% more ballots that had been asked for early voting in North Carolina. And of those numbers, of course, the Democrats had been trouncing the Republicans. And then the Republicans went on to trounce the Democrats in the state of North Carolina for the federal election. So while I think the Democrats have been very, very good at their get-out-the-vote efforts and to encourage people to vote early, I don't think it's a barometer or an indication that they're necessarily necessarily going to run away with the electorate in that particular state, regardless of what the numbers for ballots, Republican or Democrats, might be for early voting.
Donna, there's also the issue of race. The Associated Press says that in Louisiana, which is your state, more than 31% of early voters are black. In Florida, nearly 55% of early voters are registered Democrats. So race and party affiliation playing into things there. What's the incentive for people to vote early? And do you think it's a good idea?
Yes. 4 years ago, only about 10 states allow people to vote early to avoid the congestion, the gridlock on election day. Now, of course, it's a easy, convenient way for people to vote on weekends, to vote after work, so that they're not caught up in long lines on election day. I'm very optimistic about the numbers. Let me just say, Ron is absolutely right. Democrats might lead in terms of early voting, those people who are standing in line, but Republicans have historically a better machine when it comes to identifying people who turn in absentee ballots. So at this point in the game, 12 million voters may have already cast their ballots across the country in states like Colorado, Nevada. Of course, we've heard Louisiana, Georgia, Florida, where Governor Chris, to his credit, and I want to say thank you, Governor Chris, has signed an emergency order to allow voting to take place up to 12 hours a day, including on weekends, to accommodate all of the excitement going on in that great state. So this is a good sign that our democracy is healthy, that members of every community will have access to the ballot. And we all know that on election day, we have to be very careful to read the ballot before we punch whatever candidate or whatever ballot proposition. Know your rights before you show up on election day.
Let's move on to the closing statements. Barack Obama has stuck to the consistent theme of change in these final days.
The change we need isn't just about new programs and policies. It's about a new attitude. It's about new politics. A politics that calls on our better angels instead of encouraging our worst instincts.
Now, the Republicans have been pressing a new theme, warning voters against a Democratic-controlled White House and Congress.
Now, this election comes down to how you want your hard-earned money spent. Do you want to keep it invested in your future or have it taken by the most liberal person to ever run for the presidency and the Democratic leaders, the most liberal, who have been running Congress for the past 2 years, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid? You know, my friends, this is a dangerous threesome.
The dangerous threesome. Now, Ron, it has occurred many times when one party controls both branches of the legislature plus the White House. People get angry at that. They start blaming that party. Do you think that this is a good theme, though, considering that the election hasn't occurred yet? Is this a good theme for Senator McCain to pursue?
Well, I think it's a good theme, but for goodness sakes, where has the McCain campaign been talking about this for the last several months? I would have hammered away on this much, much earlier in the year. Now it starts to look like it's a little too late. You know, they're looking for some traction, and I hope they do get that traction. Look, if you have one of the most democratically or liberal Democrats running for president, and you have someone who has said that they want to raise taxes, you have someone who has indicated that they don't understand what the middle class is, you know, is it 20,000, is it 250,000, is it 125,000, and you have people in the Congress without those checks and balances, I think that we're going to have an increase in taxes, and that's not good for many working Americans. I think what the electorate would like to see is a divided government to at least have the Republicans to have enough votes in the United States Senate where they would have the opportunity to stop some of these votes, stop some of these tax increases.
Donna, what are you hearing in the final days from these two candidates?
Well, I'm hearing Senator Obama make an appeal on what's in the best interest of our country, not so much a partisan appeal, but more of an American appeal, the things that we share in common as citizens of this great democracy, and to come together at a time of economic crisis and to reject the politics of the
bizarre
past, the politics of fear, the politics of smearing one opponent. And let me just say this as someone who has not just been a Capitol Hill staffer, but watch the Republicans who constantly attack so-called progressives or liberals as being big spenders. We've seen 8 years of Republican rule where we've seen the deficit grow by leaps and bounds to almost now $10 trillion. And where was this concern about one-party rule when the Republicans tried to privatize Social Security in 2005
right.
and to bring Terry Schiavo back from the living dead? So
okay,
I think
I'm gonna
this
jump
is, again,
in.
A very smear tactic, and Senator Obama has not said he will raise taxes on the middle class. Rather, he will cut taxes and try to bring us back to some fiscal sanity.
All right, Donna, and this is a speed round, guys. I know it's hard for you. Ron, do you think it's a smart idea for Barack Obama to air this 30-minute political infomercial? And does it arguably undercut his initial promise to stick to public financing? Ron?
We might have lost him. Maybe I should help.
Yes, please help me out, Donna.
First of all, this is a historic election. We know that regardless of who's elected next week, that this country will make history. And I think this is Senator Barack Obama's opportunity to lay out to the American people the kind of changes he envisioned as president and the kind of changes we should expect, a change from the business as usual, a change from the status quo. And I think this is a very important moment to listen to his comments and to see if his vision is compelling enough for voters to go out and support him on Tuesday, November 4th.
All right. Since we couldn't get Ron back in time, one final question for you. One more speed round. Oh, hey, Ron.
I'm back.
Hey, you're back.
Ron, I stepped in for you and said that you could not wait to see Senator Obama tonight, and then you're going to watch the Phillies and Tampa, the Tampa
Bay Rays.
All right.
We only have a couple seconds. Is it fair game or smart for Senator Obama to run this infomercial?
I think it could be a saturation point. You're starting to see a little Obama fatigue, Obama mania, all the magazines, all the television coverage. Candidly, I don't think he needs the 30-minute infomercial. I think
okay.
he has the exposure, and people know who he is and what he's running on.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. We have been speaking with Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies, also former special assistant to President George W. Bush, who joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., plus Democratic strategist Donna Brazile, author and nationally syndicated columnist. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama is going primetime. Tonight, the Democratic presidential contender is going to air a 30-minute infomercial on CBS, NBC, Fox, and a few cable networks. The last candidate to buy major TV time, well, that was independent Ross Perot back in 92. We've been talking about that and more on our blog this week. We've got Jeffrey Bennett with us. He's the web producer for News and Notes. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So, no one knows quite what to expect from this infomercial tonight. He hasn't been releasing, the senator, that is, information on notes, any kind of leaks. Mm-hmm. So what are people saying online?
Well, we asked our readers to tell us how they think Obama should craft this 30-minute TV event. And we got a bunch of responses, like this one from Diana Schellenberger, who said it would be good for Obama to use it like one of FDR's fireside chats. And then another one of our readers named Kedar Coleman tried to bring the jokes. He said, with the infomercial, Obama should ensure white folks that Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and Louis Farrakhan will not be offered cabinet positions and publicly acknowledge some of the black folks who've helped him arrive at this historic occasion, including his barber, since his lineup and waves have been consistently tight, Coleman says. So some advice there that I'm sure the Obama campaign would find funny, if not useful.
All right. Yeah. I guess no one is suggesting, cheerleaders, basketball game,
right.
any of that. Anyway, Election Day, less than a week away. Can you believe it?
Yeah,
it's
really.
Like crazy. Anyway, in addition to the presidential contest, you have these ballot initiatives, Proposition 8 here in California, which deals with same-sex marriage. What are we learning about those initiatives and what people think?
Yeah, well, Prop 8 here in California sparked a conversation on our blog about gay rights versus civil rights and a wide-ranging conversation about the merits of marriage as an institution, the history of black civil rights, and the conflict between religion and government. So that debate is ongoing. And we also have a resource on our blog. Much has been made about early voting and the long lines that are expected on Election Day. Well, if you're forced to wait in line for a few hours, you can find out in advance if you are allowed time off by your employer, depending on what state you live in. So people can go to our blog and find out more information about that.
And we had a very special guest in our studio yesterday.
Yeah, Darius Rucker, the former frontman of Hootie and the Blowfish, just released a country music album. And he sat for an interview with you and then performed three songs for us. So one of those songs is on our blog today, and here's a part of it.
makes a pot of coffee and splashes the water on his face. His wife gives him a kiss and says it's gonna be okay. It won't be like this for long.
Yeah, that was his next single called It Won't Be Like This for Long, and that was Darius Rucker performing here in our studio.
Yeah, and he's been doing really well on the country charts.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. He talked a lot about, you know, what it's like to be a family man on the road, and you know, you guys have been doing a great job with the video. So,
thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from the studios of NPR West. Now we've got our bloggers roundtable with Arlene Fenton, who runs the blog Black Women Vote, and Wayne Bennett, an attorney who blogs as The Field Negro. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Great, Fry.
So this year, more than 30 states are going to allow any registered voter to cast an early ballot, and there's a heavy black turnout that exit polls are showing. So, Wayne, why do you think that early voting is appealing to black voters in particular?
Well, I think it's partly because of the Obama ground team and his organizations in various cities and states down south. I think that's the primary reason. I think they're getting people out. They realize that if you get people out now, you won't have the problems that everyone is, you know, thinking that we're going to have come Election Day. So I think it's a good move on their part, and apparently it's been working. Places like Georgia and North Carolina, they've been having record turnouts of African-American voters going to the polls early.
One thing I noticed, Arlene, is that a lot of people, although there's this, you know, big early turnout, a lot of people are sending these emails and posting online like, okay, well, the polls are looking good for Obama, but don't tell anyone because these fools ain't going to go out and vote. Have you seen stuff like that?
I've definitely seen them, and I actually think they have a point. It is possible to get overconfident and stay home and adversely affect the election, so I think it's appropriate for them to do that.
But does early voting really solve that issue? I guess it.
No.
No.
No, I don't think it does at all. In fact, you know, my parents voted early. I think they voted yesterday, but that's because they're headed to the Ukraine. But the thing is, I think that people are very fearful that something will happen on Election Day. We still have these recollections of dimpled and hanging chads and all of this stuff. So I guess some people are thinking, if I go early and there's something wrong, I can at least go back on November 4th and vote correctly. So it's a historic thing, and everybody wants to participate. And I think it's a very good sign.
Let's talk.
So many people coming early.
Let's talk a little bit about this TV special. Senator Obama has been spending huge sums of money on this 30-minute special airing on several major networks. So that means he's had to buy all of the airtime. But ABC and the CW network are saying no thanks. Why do you think, Wayne, that they chose to take a pass?
I have no idea, but as someone who's from who's in Philly now, and I'm caught up in this wave of Philly mania, I can't think of a worse time for. I know the Obama people were hoping for a sweep the other night because then they wouldn't have to deal with the World Series, but I think ABC. I don't know why they decided not to do that. I think they've been trying to kind of come down. They feel this is what I think. I think they view NBC as the left and Fox is kind of going right. So they're trying to kind of play it down the middle. And I think there are some political overtones involved. I'm sure people on the right are not pleased that he's buying up this infomercial. And I think they kind of wanted to play, you know, well, we're real journalists here. And even though he's paying for the time, we're not going to allow it in prime time.
Arlene, we just heard from Ron Christie, who basically said Senator Obama is reaching saturation, media saturation, and that he's going to start turning people off if he turns up too much. Do you think that's possible? You know, over-familiarity?
I think in some markets, yes. I think that there's getting some traction with the argument that he has so much more money. Of course, the argument would not have been made if the opposite was true, but the reality is there are some people out there who think that he is essentially buying this election. And so for people who are bent toward that, I think it would be a turnoff to see him, you know, do something that they know McCain cannot afford. However, if there is a significant amount of undecided voters, I think that this would be very appropriate because I think this is basically their last chance to really hear from the man straight up. So I, at least in the markets where I am, that's the New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia area, I don't think they've reached market saturation. Now, the problem is, if it starts to interfere with the World Series, they're not going to care about saturation or not.
That'll be market saturation right there.
Right, instant saturation.
Well, we are going to be joined in a second by Kevin Ross. He is a former Los Angeles Superior Court judge and, of course, blogs over at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. So I'm going to give him a chance to settle into the seat. And really, there's an issue here that you referenced, which is financing. CNN host Campbell Brown wrote an online piece referencing the expensive ad buy and saying that Obama, quote, pledged to accept public financing and to work with the Republican nominee to ensure that they both operated within those limits, that is, campaign finance limits. He broke his promise. Kevin, does that matter to you?
No, not at all. Because when you really look at what's going on with this election, you have a situation where, I mean, I had someone send me an invitation saying, we're having a $10 rent party for Barack Obama. You know, you have people that want to be engaged in the process of this electoral, historic, unprecedented race. And in Obama's case, while he said, I'm not going to just take money from anywhere, I'm going to, you know, comply with the rules of campaign finance, I think his situation just allowed for it to just go as far as he can take it. I'm excited about it, as you can tell in my voice. So it's not one of those things where I spend a lot of time thinking about it.
Arlene, there's also been, we had a nice conversation on the show yesterday about endorsements with some people from the newspaper industry and some observers of the newspaper industry. But there have also been some unusual ones. There was what the New York Times called the endorsement from hell, and that is that an Al-Qaeda website came out in support of McCain and went into great detail about why they thought that electing Senator McCain would further their goals of starting world war. What do you do when something like that comes out? Anything?
What do you do? I don't think there's anything you can do. You can't stop people from endorsing you or not. And in fact, I don't think that the average citizen is swayed one way or the other. Americans are fiercely independent thinkers. I think that the only thing an endorsement is going to do is probably further entrench someone who agrees with them in the first place. But I think the days of any one person or a small group of people influencing an election through an endorsement are over, probably from the days of like maybe Nixon and Watergate, just, you know, offending the public trust. I don't think people are going to buy that endorsement coming on high.
Wayne, there was Colin Powell's endorsement, but then former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan announced during a taping of comedian D.L. Hughley's new show on CNN that he's voting for Obama. So, you know, he released a book, McClellan did, deriding his time working with President Bush. But do you think that those cross-party endorsements actually make a difference?
He just did that because he was on a black show. He was
endorsing
the
you.
Black guy. No,
you leave Scott alone.
I don't think Scott McClellan, no. I don't think, in fact, I'm not even sure if a lot of people on Obama's team really welcome that endorsement, although it does show that, you know, here's a guy who used to work for the president, and he's, you know, he's seen it from the inside, what goes on in the White House, and he says, you know what? I'm going with the other guy. But I don't think his endorsement's going to make any difference. Like Arlene said, Republicans are going to vote, you know, how they're going to vote. The independents might be swayed somewhat by Colin Powell because he does have credibility among independents still. So I think his endorsement was much more significant than Scott McCallum.
I totally disagree here. If you look and see, give me one black Democrat who has said, I am voting for John McCain. I mean, when you look at the people who are coming out on the Republican side voting for Barack, and you contrast that with high-profile Democrats who are saying they're voting for McCain, you can't even compare. These endorsements are, for me, really compelling.
All right, Kevin, let me stay with you for a second. So D.L. Hughley is the one who got the, you know, the announcement on his show. His show on CNN has stirred up some controversy, but he's no stranger to incendiary comments. Now, this is not from his new show, but these were his comments last year about Don Imus and the Rutgers women's basketball team.
And then let's face it, you know, he called them hoes, nappy-headed hoes, and they weren't hoes. But it was some nappy-headed women on that team. Shut up, I'm gonna say it. I don't give a damn y'all like it or not. You know it's true. Them is some of the ugliest women I ever seen in my whole life. You kidding me?
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Okay. Yeah, that got him the title Black Imus and the Wrath of a Lot of Sisters. So, Kevin, I understand you grew up with this man.
I have known D.L. Hughley since I was, 14? We went to high school together. When he talks about the fact that he was a thug, he was. And when he talks about the fact that he didn't go to class, he didn't. When he talks about getting high, yes, I saw it. I can give a testimonial. So to see this brother go from being the biggest of knuckleheads to, you know, dropping out of high school and then making the decision, I'm going to man up, get my GED, marry my high school sweetheart, who's a sister, have three kids, including one who, and I mean, when I say sister, I'm not talking about, and I love the light-skinned black women, but I'm talking about she's a sister. And for him to have raised his family, to still have stayed married through hard work, I mean, he is the American dream. So for me, when folks clown DL, I'm like, no, you got to step back. Now, I'm not real crazy about the show right now. I hope it's going to grow on me because I wasn't feeling it. But he, as a person, you just can't get any better in terms of someone who really personifies what all of us as African Americans would want for ourselves, family, and friends.
Arlene, a lot of women's groups are coming out and saying, but he's a misogynist. What do you feel?
Kevin, sorry, I can't step with you on this one. Mm-mm. He said, let's face it. No, let's really face it, okay? D.L. Hughley is not the brightest bulb. He's a one-trick pony, and every joke has the same formula. You get some unsuspecting white folk from middle America, you add a caricature of black ignorance and pathology, you stir to a froth, you heat and serve. He does not have the
talent.
Then
how come we don't have brothers
skills?
All over the place having shows on CNN? This brother is 45 years old. He has been in the game from entertaining shows.
I don't care how old he is.
No, but I'm just saying,
Kevin,
listen
to me for a second.
All right,
you
my
know,
sister.
I let you speak.
My queen.
He's not the first black man to marry a dark-skinned black woman.
No, I didn't
He's
say
not
that.
The
okay.
first black man to care for his children, okay? He doesn't get brownie points. That's what you're supposed to do, okay? And I don't think, personally, that he is producing anything of value on CNN. CNN is one of my favorite channels.
Right.
It's a place that I go to escape stereotypes.
Right. All right, wait, Wayne, let me toss you this curveball.
Me. No.
Yes, but as you give us our final thought for the day, who else do you think should get a show in the post-election sweepstakes? Just add that into whatever you were going to say.
Who else? I was focused on DL in this show.
Go for it.
You know what? I really am disappointed in CNN for giving D.L. Hughley a show.
Come on, my brother, come on.
No, but here's the thing, Kevin. It's a political show.
That's right.
A political show. Why do you give a black comedian a show? I mean, and I agree with you here, Kevin. I saw some of the first ones. They were horrible. I mean, the pimp... don't even get me started, man. I mean,
we got to finish.
We have HBO for a reason. You just don't put DL on CNN. Sorry.
Can I just say one thing?
Okay, Kevin.
All right.
Micro.
We have to have this conversation. So Wayne and I on Blog Talk Radio, we're going to keep talking about DL tonight and really get deep into this. Because tonight on Blog Talk Radio, me and Wayne are going to go head up about DL.
We're going to talk about it. I'm sorry. I can't co-sign on that, my brother.
And I think Arlene probably will call in, but we got to wrap it up.
Around, Kevin. I'll meet you tonight.
That sounds like a threat and a promise, guys. Thank you so much. We have been talking with Arlene Fenton from the blog Black Women Vote and attorney Wayne Bennett, who blogs as The Field Negro. Both were at Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia, plus incendiary former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He also hosts The Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio, and he was with me at NPR West. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And next on News and Notes, we spend some time with the legendary gospel group, the Soul Stirrers.
We'll never more roam, go. And when we get there,
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Singer Jennifer Hudson won an Academy Award for her role in Dreamgirls, but in the last week, her family life has become the stuff of nightmares. Some people now say neighbors should have done more. Did Hudson's family try in vain to distance itself from the man who's now a person of interest in the case? Plus, a federal judge in Missouri blocks part of a new law designed to keep sex offenders away from kids on Halloween. We'll take a look at these cases with Judge Lynn Toler. She's the star of TV's Divorce Court and the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. Hi, Judge Toler.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I am doing great. So, this is just such a horrific story. Fans and everyday people around the country were shocked on Friday when performer Jennifer Hudson's mother and older brother were found shot to death. And then there was this 3-day search, her 7-year-old nephew's body found. Nobody's been charged with these murders yet, but the police have been questioning the boy's stepfather, the estranged husband of Jennifer Hudson's sister. And what we want to talk about with you is really about responsibility from a distance. First off, people heard gunshots, didn't call them in. People apparently have heard gunshots before and got tired of calling in. What does that say about people's responsibility level and also their ability to cope with a relentless assault on what may be their sense of safety?
I think it speaks less to the responsibility level than you would otherwise think, and it speaks more to the second thing that you talked about, which is the ability to cope. You talk to people who have been through terrible times or in a war zone or all of this. You become somewhat removed from the anxiousness and the upset. If you shot off a gun in my neighborhood, everybody would call in because it's extraordinary, it's different, it's frightening. But if you are in a neighborhood where you could hear gunshots every night, if your level of expectation continued to be high with that, you have difficulty living. So it is a coping mechanism and a process that you use in order to remain okay in a situation where things are generally not okay.
Is this different from the bystander effect, which is what some people use as a term to talk about when people actually see a crime and still don't do anything about it?
Because the bystander effect being that they thought somebody else would call in,
yeah,
or I don't want to get involved. And I think it is different from the bystander effect because it depends on the community that you're in and what becomes normal for that community and what causes concern in that community. That changes depending upon the way the community does. Now, having said that, I will say this. We have become a society who says, not me, not get involved. One, out of fear, because you don't want to get involved. You think you'll get hurt, too. And number two, I think we've become attenuated as a society for a variety of reasons. One, because of our mobility. I don't live where my grandmother lived, where her mother lived, where my uncles and cousins and aunts are. And most people don't anymore. Or not anymore, but we're so much more of a mobile society. And we're becoming a technological society. My husband yesterday called my son on his cell phone from our bedroom to his room to tell him to do something. I mean, and we've got a virtual world. I did a blog once where, you know, people saying, yes, I feel much better in this world. We're losing that sense of contact and community. So I think it's happening on a variety of levels.
Now, the, quote, person of interest being held is someone who served 7 years for attempted murder and carjacking. Again, he's just a person of interest at this point. But let's put it in the context of our lives, which is that if you have a family member who is making choices to be with someone who is problematic legally or in terms of domestic violence, how do you approach a conversation with someone like that?
It is the most difficult thing in the world to do. And even once you get a person in court, because I used to do a lot of domestic violence cases, it is difficult. The response that you get is, but I love him. And to deal with that, I think Pascal said, is that the heart has reasons that reason knows nothing of. All the logic in the world is very difficult to use on a person who says that. So what I think we need to do as mothers and as fathers is have the conversation before the love ever hits. And because once you're in love or believe that you're in love, it's a very, very difficult thing to talk someone out of.
Well, again, our hearts go out to the Hudson family. I wanted to bring up one more thing, though, which is that, you know, Friday night is, in happy terms for a lot of kids, the night of ghouls and goblins. But there are these sex offender registries that reveal that in most of our neighborhoods, there are people who've been convicted of crimes, including attacking children. So Missouri enacted a law restricting convicted sex offenders on Halloween, and convicted sex crime offenders would be prohibited from leaving their homes between 5 p.m. and 10:30. They would also have to hang a sign on their door that says no candy or treats at this residence. But a federal judge temporarily blocked the curfew for this Friday. The case is still in appeal. So what was it about this law that didn't pass the smell test for the judge?
It was vague and overbroad. That's what didn't pass the smell test. What is just cause? They say that the sex offender can leave for just cause. So how do you define just cause? Is that a trip to the pharmacy to get some aspirin, or does it have to be a medical emergency? And also they're saying Halloween-related contact with children. Does that mean a man? And I believe that was one of the four sex offenders who brought this, says, I have a nephew or a son or something that's living in my house. Does that mean I cannot carve a pumpkin in my own home with my child? They didn't block the entire law. The part where that says they have to post a sign, they have to keep their lights off and post a sign, you know, no trick-or-treating here, that remained in effect because it didn't have that constitutional question of how do we conform our behavior to it. If a law is too broad or too vague, people don't know what they should and should not do, and it has to be adequately defined.
What should communities do? Not just the legal system, but what's a smart way for communities to deal with an issue like this?
The smart way for communities to deal with an issue like that is to hearken back to what we were talking about with Jennifer Hudson. Make sure your community is a community. Make sure you know your neighbors and what is going on. Make sure you are making a conscious effort to deal with the distance and the attenuation that we have in our communities based on our mobility and technology. So if you know who's there, whose children are where, what's going on, and if you have that sense of community, that is the quickest and best way to make sure your community can stay safe.
Judge Toler,
from within.
Judge Toler, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of TV's Divorce Court. She is also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
The Soul Stirrers have inspired gospel and R&B audiences since the 1930s. At different times, the group included legends Sam Cooke, Lou Rawls, and Johnny Taylor. And they've still got a mix of founding members and men who joined them along the way. After a long hiatus, they're back together with a new album, A Soul-Stirring Reunion. Leroy Kroom, Arthur Kroom, Willie Rogers, and Floyd Taylor joined us in the studio. I started by asking if going on the road was different now than when they first started with the Soul Stirrers.
If you want to go back that far.
I do.
When I first started with the Soul Stirrers, there were no drums, there was no piano, there was no organ. It was only an acoustic guitar. which I was playing, and the acoustic guitar that I played, I bought it when I was a kid, and I paid $11.95 for it. And I don't mean $1,100, $11.95 for it. And I had a paper route in Chicago. I put 50 cents down on it because I was only making $1.50-something a week. And then I pay a quarter here and a quarter there. Put it on layaway. And I finally got it out. And that's what I was playing when my oldest brothers got us together for the Croom Brothers. Uh-huh. And then when I came to the Soul Stirrers, that's the way it was back then. And I'm not going to tell you what year it was.
Well, you mentioned the Croom Brothers. You have the song Resting Easy. And Dillard is someone who passed away.
Yes.
Just this year. I don't know if anyone else has a reminiscence about him and what he brought to the group.
Yeah, that was my brother. And he was the one that called me about this project. You know, I was away from the entertainment at the time. And I told him I wasn't interested, really. And he says, no sense in us doing it if you don't do it because you're the history, you know. Mm-hmm. Because I go so far back, I'm the last one standing from the original guys, you know. So he said he wanted to do it, and I told him, yeah, okay, I'll do it. That's how that happened.
Standing with his arms wide open, waiting to welcome me. I'll be resting. Oh, yeah.
Well, Floyd, let me go to you, because you got passed the baton in a way from your father. What was it like to have a different legacy with the group, to have had your father be in the group and then you be in the group now?
Very thrilling, I'll use that word, because my dad sung with these guys. And to be able to stand in a room with them and to be around all this history as coming up as a kid and knowing that my dad did this, it was a very, very thrilling thing for me.
Willie, were you in the group when Sam Cooke was in the group?
No, I wasn't. I came later on, around 65, yes. The Soul Stirrers was such a great influence on me as a young kid from Virginia when I first heard the Soul Stirrers and the unique sound of the late Sam Cooke at that time, and Leroy was with them at that time, and I was, you know, I don't want to talk about Leroy age.
Please.
But anyway, the music of the Soul Stirrers was such a music. That's why it lasted so long today. That's why the music went to R&B and the secular world and the gospel world, because the sound was so unique.
Yeah.
You could sing a love song like Darling You Send Me, and then The Love of God that Leroy wrote, and mm-hmm. this type of song, and it matches each other. You know what I'm saying? It's just the lyrics that change. And the music seemed to connect to the audience.
The love of God guides me along my way. The love of God will never let me stray. The love of God will always be there for
the love of God.
The love of God I know is everywhere.
Well, Arthur, I want to turn to you. There was in 1989, your group was honored by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as one of rock's early influences. What does that mean to you, for good or bad, to have that kind of recognition?
It means a lot to us to be honored like that. And you see the goodness of your work come up right before your eyes. And we were fortunate enough to live to hear it instead of we've been a lot of them passed on before they reached that level. And I'm blessed to be here, and I'm blessed to be taking it on to another level, you know.
Arthur, you seem to have a deep reserve of spiritual strength. What has singing done for you, and what has your singing, you think, done for other people, perhaps people who were going through times of need?
You asked me what the Lord have done for me?
Yeah.
Okay. The Lord hath brought me through dangers and dangers unseen. He gave me a voice. He gave me strength and enough to still carry it on for all of these many years.
Leroy, we have only touched on Sam Cooke, mm-hmm. but he is a man who is known so much for his secular music and mm-hmm. for providing these moments that people remember, oh, I was listening to this song at this time in my life. But what was he like when he was in the Soul Stirrers?
I'll tell you a little story about it. We were cut-ups, you know. Mm-hmm. We were sitting in the back seat of the car going to the Apollo Theater, and we heard this record come on the radio. And I says, wow, who is that singing that song? And nobody knew. And I told Sam at the time, I said, Sam, you know what? We're going to fire you, man. We're going to hire this guy right here. You know who that guy was?
Who?
It was Johnny Taylor.
Uh-huh.
It's somewhere to
yep.
lay my head. Yeah,
yep.
That's what he was saying.
Floyd's father.
Yeah, I said, we're fine. And he just cracked up. He said, you guys, do you hear this? What this guy is telling me? He going to fire me? And so happened, that's who we got after Sam left. JT, Johnny Taylor.
I just want you to each tell me one song, one Soul Stirrers song that you particularly love and think people should listen to.
My favorite song was When I Bid Farewell. Arthur Croom wrote that from Over the Meat.
Going way back in the 60s. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Floyd Taylor.
A little flower that blooms in May.
Sam
Cooke. A lovely sunset at the end of a day.
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
Someone happened. A stranger along the way. Mm. That's heaven to me. That's the finish of that line.
That's heaven.
That's
We've
heaven
had a little bit of heaven right here.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're
so
welcome.
Much.
The minister was preaching and the crowd.
That was Leroy Croom, Arthur Croom, Willie Rogers, and Floyd Taylor of the Soul Stirrers. They released a Soul Stirring Reunion in September, and they joined us from our studios at NPR West.
That was so loud and clear. You know the crowd that stood around him. They was crying. I could plainly see for the song that they sang.